The Islamic mystic said, look in yourself. Look in your own heart, for this is the beginning of sanctuary. And within your own consciousness is the secret garden of your hope. Here each individual, perhaps sometimes under a bit of neurosis, creates an imaginary world, a world of the dreams of things as he would like them to be. And if we could know all these dreams, we might be rather surprised, for most of them would be very much alike. In our hearts, we all dream of the same things. But we are unable to transform these dreams into activities of conduct. We have been hurt. We have been offended. We have been frustrated. So we nurse our dreams in secret. Yet under analysis, under scientific consideration, the beauties that we hold dear are much alike in all peoples. And they all have something to do with the building of a world of peace. I think all nations and all faiths of importance in the world today have the common vision of the end of war. The creation of peace, even our stoutest adversaries, in the secrecy of themselves, realize that only peace can heal up the wounds that have afflicted the world since the beginning. We have known this, but we have not been able to make it work. We have not yet been able to bind men's purposes together. We have not been able to overcome the instinct of competition and to create in its place a consciousness of cooperation. If religion has failed, at least to now, to really achieve this end, it rather means that faith, as we know it, has not been strong enough to overcome selfishness. But in the process of the moment, there seems to be a stronger weapon rising, and that is man's consummate fear. Today, man fears tragedy far more intensely than ever in the past has he hoped for good. Today, it is becoming increasingly obvious that this better way of life must either find its place among us, or we may not be able to survive at all. This is a serious thought. This may force us into a reevaluation of the work at hand. And if a certain stress, strain, or crisis achieves this end, it is worth its passing cost. For the answer remains as it has always been, that we must either understand or suffer. Perhaps out of the tremendousness of our need, and out of the stronger facilities that we now possess for estimating the magnitudes of things, we shall have new incentives for cooperation and understanding. It will be sad if these incentives have to be negative. But even though they may start negative, ultimately their own rewards will restore their positive equilibrium. For as we perceive the practical workings of constructiveness, we can no longer deny its right or deny its supremacy in our affairs. Now, there have been some who have attempted to visualize the utopia of the future. You all remember Bellamy's Looking Backwards, a rather strange name because it was really looking forward. But man, even a man like Bellamy, could not quite escape the binding patterns of contemporary things. Ignatius Donnelly in Caesar's Column attempted the same thing, but with only mediocre success. These men could not know the changes that were to follow their own lives by 25 or 50 years. They could not sense the magnitudes of world motion in the last 50 years. But in all, utopians in general, realize that what we call a perfect state today must be actually a world state. The only foundation big enough for the everlasting house is the whole planet. Its tessellated floor must be the earth, and the magnificent span of its ceilings must be the heavens, and its ornaments must be the stars. Nothing less than this one house, nothing less than this one world, built over the ashes of many worlds, can meet the challenge of our present consciousness. This does not mean that we want to have a world of conformists. This does not mean that all who can build this house must have only one thought and one mind. But it does mean that each must have as a common denominator with all the others the great thought in the divine mind. It would be too bad indeed if every nation lost its cultures, lost its ancient traditions, its arts, and its crafts, and that we all came to look alike, and that from the north to the south, we would wear fedora hats or toreador pants. This is something more horrible than we can even contemplate. Perhaps total extinction would be preferable. But it does mean that in the great essentials of things, we must learn to work together. We must learn to pray together, even though each may pray to his own concept of God. We must give every man this right. We do not care the name of the deity to whom he prays. What we want to know is he a faithful workman, chewing his stone for this house of eternal progress? We do not care what his language may be, for his works speak for him. And if they do not speak, his language fails in any event. We do not care how far away he is or how near. All we need to know is that a dedicated humankind has resolved to labor together for the common good. This is the sacred place upon which our house must be built. And of course, the early Christians were of the opinion that it was quite possible that this new Jerusalem would descend upon the stony, rocky crest of Golgotha, that it was upon bleak Calvary upon which the Messiah died that the new temple of everlasting truth would be built. Well, whether it is the floor of the Jebusite, or the sand of Gobi, or the rocky crest of Calvary, always the symbolism is approximately the same in meaning. For this rocky place of death is the symbol of this world, a world in which truth has long died for the selfishness of men. And this everlasting house is to be an eternal memorial to those who gave their all through all time to make this building possible. So it stands upon the blood of martyrs. It rises from the graves of heroes. And beneath it sleep the giants of ancient times, to bear it as Atlas bore the earth upon his shoulders. This house, as we look upon it today, this coming world, is a fair place. It can be much a garden. It can be filled with all wonders, great galleries and museums, in which men will study the works of men. It will be dotted with monuments to human achievement, many little shrines, like the small shrines in a church, gathering like little hills around the great mountains of the high altars. All of these wonderful beauties, these paths that men have trod, can be marked within this house, as are the stations of the cross. Therefore, in this house, there is no need of conflict. There is no need of disbelief or unbelieving. In this house also, the scholars will come. For out of their wisdom has come the laws which made so much of this possible. The scientist, the physician, the legislator, the lawyer. All these, if they have been true workmen, have put their proper stones in this house. And to the degree that they have been dedicated, they have advanced it. To the degree they have been selfish, they have delayed it. But by a law beyond men, the building goes on. And there is a legend that when Solomon's house was being built, one workman went to sleep. And in the morning, his stone was not ready. And in the emergency, the prince of evil came and trod the stone to make his offering to the everlasting house. It's a rather interesting thought. But even the wrongdoer, even the spirit of hate and deceit, in some mysterious way, indirectly but inevitably, contributes to the glory of this labor. For just as surely as virtue brings the day closer, so sin reveals the need to be greater. Everything plays part in this. And we are coming very close today to a time when we must begin to plan this. In the days of the old mystics of Israel, there were mostly deserts and a few cities, and the Western world was comparatively unknown unless the Chinese had found out about it. They did not know anything about the tremendous pressure of world affairs as we understand them, but the pattern, the trestle board, remains as it was with them. For whether there be few or many, all must cooperate. Whether there be little villages or great cities, the need is the same. It is ever the struggle against ignorance and superstition and fear, the struggle for the building of a nobler way of life. Now, if man will build this house of the future, his religions, his philosophies, and his faiths, tell him that it must be a strange symbol. It must again bear witness to all the laws of nature. In the structure of this city or this temple, every inconsistency must be reconciled. Every conflict must be remedied or removed. Every possible fault must be corrected. Otherwise, the house will not stand. When it is complete, therefore, it is a shining, glittering, mysterious, crystal-like monument. A perfect representation in the life of man of the law of heaven. Heaven thus comes to earth when its rules become the ways of human conduct. The power of heaven is vindicated only when man discovers that by no other power can his own works be perfected. So it is said that the power of God or the glory of God is revealed through this great work, which shines like the eternal city of Revelation. And it is built upon a great foundation made of the precious jewels of virtue and integrity. Now, when this city is so built, and its peoples have all achieved their proper labors, and the time comes for each workman to receive the compensation for his labor, that compensation will be indeed more than sufficient. For in that compensation, he will be rewarded by having a world worth living in. A world in which all things that are real can have their chance. Now, there is an ancient legend also in the Kabbalah that when this world has finally been made so perfect that it is indeed heaven on earth, then a double mystery will occur in space. Heaven will descend and occupy this house, and this house will ascend and occupy heaven. They will be brought together as one house. There will no longer be any division between things mortal and things immortal, between the human and the divine. Perhaps this is a religious symbol to signify the final identity of human consciousness with the consciousness of God. Perhaps what they are telling us is that this whole great discipline is a kind of yoga, and that in the final realization of it, not as an experience of consciousness alone, but as an experience of consciousness made manifest in the flesh of things, that when man achieves this marvelous insight, creates this nirvanic structure, achieves this Atman of attainment, that he will be united forever with the everlasting plan, which is, of course, the great house. In any event, our present project does not necessarily burden us with the direct challenge of ultimates. What we are concerned with at the present moment is to make our proper footings in this great plan. We do not claim that the vision of the Supreme Architect has been bestowed upon us. We do not say that we know the end. All that we know is that we have been given certain skills, and that we are confronted by certain unfinished work, that the great structure of universal life is as yet unfinished, that it is our right and privilege, therefore, to build upon the old footings only that which we can understand and know to do. We can make our contribution. We are not expected to finish it, but we are expected to leave it more advanced than we found it, certainly no worse. We are expected to have evidenced our sincerity by joining the builders of the past in passing on to the future a work further advanced in all of its essential parts. We do this same thing in the building of humanity itself. Human society is a great building. Through our children and our grandchildren, we pass on something of a maturing humanity that must sometime come of age, and in its maturity shall glorify all that has labored to bring about this better condition. Now, in the Christian mysteries, and to a measure also in the Jewish mysteries, because these were very closely related, particularly in their beginnings, there was a belief, a very strong belief, in a kind of spiritual magic, that anything that was perfect became ensouled by its own power. Pythagoras taught this among the Greeks. He said that when a beautiful image was created, this image became ensouled, not necessarily by a deity, he was not thinking in terms of idolatry, but was ensouled by a kind of spirit, a spirit that had a power to operate in the life of men, that beauty took up its abode in the beautiful. Virtue took up its dwelling in the virtuous. Strength made its house among the strong. Thus, everything that we do becomes in some way ensouled, by the spirit or the power we confer upon it. The everlasting house, therefore, when completed, and being a symbol of the perfected world, is also ensouled. It becomes a living thing. It becomes an entity rather than a mere entirety. All of its stones and parts are suddenly melded together by a power greater than these parts, so that out of the labors of many, there is suddenly fashioned one work. And this one work carries within it and upon it all of the virtues that have gone into the creation thereof. Today these matters perhaps concern us a little more than in the past. Perhaps the old Jewish people merely wish to create a testimony upon Zion, a reminder forever that they had not forgotten their God. But their symbolism stretches out into a much larger world. And all humanity today senses this tremendous need, this great demand for security. Though in the early rise of religious organizations, that land or ground which was set aside for the uses of religion was termed sanctified. And it was into sanctified ground that those came to rest who died firm in the doctrines of the faith. But this sanctified ground had other purposes and uses also. If those guilty of offense, of crime even, were able to reach the sanctuary of sanctified ground, they passed from the keeping of the law of men to the keeping of the law of God. Therefore, ancient religions, many of them, had what is called sanctuary. That land or ground so sanctified was not only for the use of the priests, but was a place where the tired, the sick, and the sin-laden could find at least temporary relief from the pressures of the world around them. To a measure also, this pertains to our thinking today. For if once we are able to sense the meaning of this divine house, this everlasting temple to the eternal, it will mean that the ground upon which it is built is also set apart a sanctuary, not only to receive the dead, but to protect the living. And when it comes to the protection of the living, there are many things for us to think about. For in our little man-made philosophy, we have often forgotten the God-made world. We have forgotten the divine right of flowers, the divine right of beasts. We have forgotten that all living things, fashioned by the love and wisdom of God, have their rights, their privileges. And that we, as the leaders of them, have our responsibilities and our duties. We cannot do all these things well now. Not only is our vision not adequate, but our means may not always make it possible. But we do look forward in the betterness of things, not only to a world made safe for man, but a world made safe for all creatures. A world in which everything that belongs to God is preserved in the name of God. And we are now beginning to reach that degree of our insight and knowledge in which this is reasonably possible. Again, science moves in with strange possibilities for us to consider. If the present population explosions continue, most of the sources of food and supply which we depend upon today will be inadequate. Yet this does not necessarily mean that we will all die of starvation. It means we will reach out into new mediums. We may find entirely new concepts of nutrition. The automobile lifted a great horror from the horse. And we may lift one by one the burden from all other creatures that have often sacrificed themselves for our needs. This new way of life, this new world, this new condition of the future can be one which benefits, as it must and should, all creatures that exist within the domains of heaven. And earth is one of the suburbs of this eternal state. So little by little, progress is helping us to build a house. We have numerous setbacks because we are inadequate and selfish peoples. But we also see signs of the glory to come. We begin to sense that it will be possible for men to worship side by side. That little by little, holy wars will become only sad memories in the experience of the race. We begin to sense that men will all be able to go to school and will have what they need for survival. That opportunity will not be limited by birth or estate, but that we will be recognized more and more for our works and not for these artificial boundaries by which we have previously estimated the privileges of each other. We see more and more also the possibility of the spreading of ideas through communication and transportation. We see distant and isolated places moving into their proper spots in this vast project of things. We also know that it is perfectly possible to stop war. We have not yet fully experienced the emergency, the true need of so doing, but we know that it can be done. We also know that it is perfectly possible to solve most of the social problems of mankind with fairness and equity to all. We know that if we expended the vast sums of money we are now variously wasting upon essential projects, that we could advance human health, human happiness, and human security as never before was regarded as possible. We know that we are gradually conquering the destitution of age, that by degrees we will help humanity to enjoy the full fruit of its labors in its older years. We also will be able to protect the needs of the young. Little by little, crime and pain and these other projects can be conquered. They will be conquered. But this in itself is only a motion towards something. This is not the end. But it indicates that the end is attainable. And what was once a fantastic dream of some mystic in rapture is now a solid scientific possibility. Within not the imagination, but the common thinking of large parts of the human family. But with all this planning and all this plotting and all this scheming and all this considering, we have not yet fully recognized the essential overtones of a utopian state. We have not realized that all of this is meaningless, essentially meaningless, unless it represents a dynamic, conscious, voluntary cooperation with the universe for projects far beyond the security of man. That the security of man is only incidental. It is only a proof that we know how, evidence that we are willing to try. It is our first statement of sincerity. We have risen above the smallness of our common thinking and have solved our own problem first. This is not the end, but it is a recommendation. It is an advancement. We then pass from among those of the workmen who could only carry wood and water to those better workmen who did true good stones, or who did plan the more beautiful utensils of the temple. We shall be advanced, and our wages shall likewise be increased. But our labors will not be finished. For actually, the great temple, the great symbol of this universal house, is man's citizenship in the universe itself. Man extending himself finally until he is one of the great creative agencies of nature. That he truly, as the Kabbalist pointed out long ago, shall be greater than the angels. And that man himself is a hierarch, one of the great creative orders of life. That his real labors begin in space, not simply here. This was the view of the Kabbalists, who declared that it was man's ultimate duty, ultimate privilege, to be one of the great hierarchies before the throne of eternal grace, receiving the commandments of the Most High, and going forth upon the winds like the cherubim, to carry the laws of the universe to the most ultimate distances of space. Man has a larger concept of destiny, which unfolds in him as he outgrows his own immediate smallness. Man must become vitally aware of his own immortality. He must realize his life in everlastingness. He must gradually gain the realization that he is the citizen of a great commonwealth in space. That he is an ambassador of the infinite. That he carries with him many powers and faculties which he does not dream exists as he lives today. So the old Jewish Kabbalists, in their concept of the building of the temple and the reestablishment of the holy city, were not thinking that someday the state of Israel would rise upon the ruins of Zion. They did not really mean merely the restoration of Israel or the return of the people to the land of their birth. What they really meant, as old Rabbi Akiba himself knew, was that the return of Israel was the return of the wandering human soul to its citizenship in space. That it was the coming home of the spirit from the smallness and darkness of its own defeat, returning like the prodigal son to the house of its father. This return, therefore, to the promised land is the return of the human soul to God and space and the infinite. And these terms, which to us are very abstract, are not really as abstract as we think. Space and God and the infinite are word symbols for facts that are real. We do not understand these facts. We do not know how to use them now. But we have no right to doubt that the house of the eternal stands upon the mountains of Zion. In the Eastern legends, we hear of Chang Shambhala, the city of the gods, from whose ramparts rise the lights of the Aurora Borealis. We are told of the mysterious cities of deities and of the abode of Shiva upon the tall peak of Mount Kailasa. We hear everywhere of the Olympian deities upon their mountains, and the divinities of Northlands upon the tall peaks of Asgard. All these legends of the great city of the gods in space above man, or upon the heights of the mountains to which we turn, for they are the hills from whence cometh our help. All of these represent man's recognition of the divine government that rules all things. That there is this tremendous civilization extending in space. That every star is a temple. Every galaxy is a city. The Milky Way is a vast metropolis of worlds. There is an immense empire that we know not of. And somewhere in space is the capital city, the banner city of this great diffusion. Here rules supreme the powers that engender all things, that control all things. This vaster city, so-called, we do not understand. But we know that upon the pattern of it, our own ways must be built. Even an ordinary city of today can only exist because of an interrelationship of activities almost inconceivable to the private citizen. Have we ever wondered how milk comes to the city of New York? Have we ever wondered about the vast world and network of sewerage and utilities which must be present to keep a city alive? Have we ever realized as we go along in our daily activities, making use of labors of persons we know nothing of, how this tremendous unity and economy has to be sustained by a magnificent plan? And that if anything happens to this plan, even in an ordinary city, there is chaos, destruction, and death. How much more significant, then, is this city or empire of God? We are all using it. We are all living upon it. We are all dependent upon it. Yet we have so little concept of the magnificent organization of principles and energies by means of which our various activities are sustained. How is it then, as Lord Bacon says, that God must reveal himself by miracles? For his most common and ordinary works are most miraculous. Everywhere we see this organization, this tremendous plan, and the old mystics were convinced that this plan represented a broad program of government, that as the stars mingle their rays, so men must learn to live together, that every pattern in space is lawful and reasonable and proper. And man reaching out to understand how to rule his own affairs will find the answers in the broad unrolling scroll of life itself. So to them, it was not difficult to imagine this world an empire, or space a great country populated with a variety of creatures. It was not difficult for man to assume that he had been wandering in a long darkness, a darkness biological and anthropological, that for millions of years he has wandered through darkness, that he has gone through the desert of waiting as the children of Israel wandered in the wilderness. And at last, after what science may say is 100 million years or 1,000 million years, men led and guided by some force greater than themselves have come through. They have survived more disasters than we can ever count or know. They have lived through convulsions of nature that would confound us. They struggled on through a prehistoric world with beasts far stronger than themselves. And at last, out of this long struggle, mind was born. Man came forth as a creature to think no longer merely of struggling for survival against the saber-toothed tiger or some mighty sloth of the wilderness. He came forth as a man. He saw his own image in nature. He began to think. He became a builder of cities. He advanced all kinds of knowledge. And finally he paused, as David paused. And he thanked a power greater than himself for having led him through this unknown world where he could not have led his own way. He felt that all through the ages his hand was in the hand of God, and that as a small infant he was guided and led by an all-wise and all-loving parent. And David the king said that we may commemorate this secure way in which we have passed through the wilderness, that we may give thanks and tribute to this power that has guided us through the uncertainties of ages. In honor of this, and in recognition of this, we shall build the everlasting house to our God. And this is also a part of man's problem, that man shall sometimes realize the tremendous wisdom that has guided him, that he shall give thanks for the eternal love that has protected him, and that out of the fullness and greatness of his respect and veneration and understanding, he shall now build the eternal temple on Mount Moriah. In this temple he shall give thanks, and he shall build this temple from the very arts and skills that he has learned in darkness, and all that he has gained through the ages he will dedicate to this final work. Man is no longer wandering alone in darkness, benighted and helpless. Man now has a mind and a heart. He can plan his own way. He can relieve the heavens of part of their duties and carry them himself. He can become the true and faithful servant of the very laws that once guided him. He can also become the guardian of other forms of life as he has been guarded. And out of all of his dreamings and all of his hopings, he builds the temple of his religion, his true faith. And this true faith is his wondrous recognition of the infinite skill, purpose, and law upon which his life is built. This is his new religion, cutting through all sects and creeds and standing as an eternal testament to the fact that at last he understands, that he recognizes, realizes, and appreciates the wonderful world in which he exists. And he has built a monument to his own understanding. And this monument, because he understands, is dedicated to the fountain of all understanding, that divine grace upon which all things depend for their existence. So out of the clash of creeds can come the temple of this one realization, the realization of one divine power, moving all things, guarding all things, guiding all things. And as this temple builds, man builds it because of the increasing and unfolding regard in which he holds life and holds principles and holds truths. As this temple grows, it becomes not only a place of worship, but truly the golden age he looks for. For this temple is his new world, a world in which he proves that he not only understands, but that he is grateful, and that it is now his opportunity to build his trestle board, to design his patterns, and to prove that he has learned well the lessons which he has been given through the countless, measureless periods of the prehistoric world. So as he has come out of the darkness of the wilderness and has been wonderfully rescued by God from the land of Egypt, so man today is moving through materialism, through darkness, through fear, doubt, and war. But if he keeps the faith, as the children of Israel were admonished to keep the faith, he will be brought in the fullness of time to the good land. And here in his gratitude, he will build the house of his God. And all the knowledge that he has shall adorn it. And all the spirit that he has shall worship in it. And in that time, this power shall be his God. And these people shall be the people of that God. And they shall receive the testimony of the virtues they have achieved and shall be seated forever upon the foundations of integrity. This was the old belief. It's not a bad one. Perhaps we would do better if we thought more about it than some of the little beliefs that have sort of captured our minds in recent times. But time is pretty well up, and I have a couple of announcements to make, so we'll have to consider that for this evening. I'd like to call to your attention that on Saturday, July 1st at 2:30, we are going to have this exhibition of puppet and puppet arts from Mexico. It looked for a while as though we weren't going to have them. But with more optimism than anything else, I wrote a letter to the United States Ambassador in Mexico City and told him we wanted them, so they're coming. In any event, they're on their way, according to the last reports. We didn't do it just because we wanted them to come here. They wanted to come somewhere themselves. And they wanted to attend a convention, so we kind of worked it out all around. But anyway, by the grace of the United States Ambassador and other divine powers, the puppeteers will be with us, we believe, unless some other less graceful force interacts, on July 1st at 2:30 p.m., Senor Roberto Lago and his associate from Mexico City will bring the story of puppets in Mexico. He will tell us how the Aztecs used them long before the Spaniards came, and also that Cortez, when he arrived in the Western Hemisphere, brought puppeteers with him to, engage the attention of his followers in their more peaceful moments. Also, puppetry has become part of the national life of Mexico, religiously, culturally, aesthetically. And, of course, as you probably realize, it's becoming very popular in this country, along with the general revival of interest in folk culture and folk arts. In any event, on Saturday afternoon, July 1st at 2:30 p.m., they will be with us here, and we hope that you will all make a reservation for yourself and your friends to help us to be nice to these people who are coming on a goodwill ministry here. They want to try to help to build a little better cultural sympathy between peoples. They are going to have not only a demonstration of puppetry, but they're also going to have an illustrated lecture on historical puppets and upon the development of the art among the early Mexican tribes. It'll be quite an educational thing. Children above the age of about 12 will probably be able to handle it pretty well. For small children, it probably will not be exactly the best program because it'll go over their heads to some degree. Of course, children around 80 or 90 will be really at their prime in this. But anyway, we hope that you will all come and bring friends and reserve tickets this evening if you can. I believe that we have a little notation on here. Yes. The admission is $1. Program lasts about an hour and a half. And it may be interesting to remember that on that Sunday, the following Sunday, we do not have a lecture. So it will not be necessary for you to make the two trips in 2 days to be here. We hope that you will seriously come and join in the story of these interesting puppets. I think they'll be really very, very interesting and be a far more constructive program than most of those with which we are more or less tormented on television. I also want to say that this is the last of our class series at this time, and our next Wednesday evening class will begin on, I believe, the 11th of July. You will receive your programs in due time. Of course, we have our lecture next Sunday, so we hope you'll all be with us for this occasion. And I might mention that if you're at all interested in the study of the Old Testament and the Kabbalistic lore, that you think of our book, Old Testament Wisdom, which contains a great deal of further material relating to the beliefs that we have discussed in this series of talks. We thank you very much for being with us and hope to see you again soon.